The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Scooters for the Scudetto as Napoli close in on title by beating Juventus, who still end the weekend 15 points better off. In Germany, another defeat for Bayern. That's not too cool, Thomas. La Liga, 1-0 once more for Barcelona, who continue to put the Met in La Masia. And Mbappe, Angers' Ligue 1 rivals, with a beautiful brace. This is the Totally Football Show. How you doing, listener? It's me, Matt, in Jimbo's shoes for one last time to talk all things continental. I'm joined by Julien Laurence.
Hello, man.
Bonjour.
Too cool for Thomas. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Nice.
Thanks.
It's better than Jimbo.
Alvaro Romero is also with us. How you doing, Alvaro?
Very well, thank you, Matt.
Raphael Honigstein's on board. Good morning,
Raph. Hello.
And James Horncastle, completing the quadrant.
Hello, Matt.
Let's get some moments of the weekend, shall we? James, you can go first.
Yeah, you alluded to it. Napoli players touching down at Capo del Chino and then being escorted back to the training ground by a troop of motorino.
Lovely young men.
Lovely young men.
Yeah. Three of them on each moped, no helmet.
It really means something to Naples and Neapolitans whenever a Napoli team goes to Turin and beats Juventus. To do it in the manner that they did it, quite controversial, quite Juve-like almost, but to win it in stoppage time, it's just amazing. And, you know, for a player like Raspadori, for example, to get the only goal, you know, everyone's focused on Osimhen and that sort of thing, but Raspadori will now be an absolute hero in Naples for the rest of his life, which is just awesome.
Al limite, dribbling, si va a destra, Demas, parte il cross, secondo palo, Raspadori, sinistro! Ha segnato il Napoli! 48esimo minuto!
All right, we'll talk more about that shortly. Raph, what was your moment of the weekend?
Moment of the weekend happened behind closed doors. Nobody saw it, but...
But enough about your weekend.
Yes, but the reports are very complimentary. No, what happened after the 3-1 win of Köln and Hoffenheim, Jonas Hector, the Köln captain, did a little speech and told his teammates that he was going to retire at the end of the season. And there were a lot of tears and emotions, and Steffen Baumgart afterwards talked about it, and the whole Cologne fan base, they're sad, and they want to do a choreography, because this is one of the last few sort of one-club men at this level. He went down with them, even though he had a chance to go to a better club, more money, but he said, no, it's my responsibility, so I need to go down and then take them up again. 309 league games. Still only 32, so they're hoping that he might play a bit longer, but let's call it a day. And he's going to go down as an absolute Cologne icon.
A coloss? Colognesis? Doesn't work. Alvaro, quick, help me out.
Colonoscopy?
Yes. My moment of the week is definitely the last, actually, moment of the week in La Liga, which is Sunday late evening when Nesyri scores the winner for Sevilla. Not because the goal has a lot of significance in for Sevilla in La Liga race, because they are very far away from Champions League spots, European spots, but Sevilla is still unbeaten. They beat Manchester United the other day with a brace from Nesyri. They beat Villarreal, who are European quality, and Nesyri is called now Air Nesyri. A tribute to Michael Jordan, Air Jordan, because he's basically jumping more than anybody else. We saw that in the World Cup when he jumped over 2 meters, 40 centimeters, something like that. He did it the other day against Villarreal, and his form after the World Cup is incredible. He has scored 15 goals, 5 in April, when, you know, the climbs are steeper, you have to raise your level, and Nesyri is doing it. So congratulations to him, a winner for Sevilla, and Sevilla is unbeaten with the coach Mendilibar.
Nice. Jules, what got you jumping for joy?
It can only be the incredible own goal scored by Malo Gusto for Marseille against his own team Lyon in the Olympico at the last kick of the game.
Le ballon en retrait et le but, le but, le contre son corps. Merci Lyon, merci Lyon, merci Lyon.
I don't know if the fact that he's a Chelsea player now.
No comment.
And the crisis there. Sorry, Matt, I had to go there. But yeah, it was very unfortunate. We'll explain the goal later. But his teammate tried to clear it off and he bounced it off Malo Gusto to go in. Literally the last kick of the game. And great win for Marseille, who deserved to win, to be fair. but heartbreaking moment for Gusto and for Lyon, to who needed a win as well to hope for a fifth place finish.
Very tasty on goal that was.
It was, yeah.
Sounds like he'll settle in well in SW6 then. We are going to go to Italy first of all.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network and sponsored by LiveScoreBet. You can get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
All right then, James, Napoli have the scent of the Scudetto in their sinuses this after Giacomo Raspadori plundered that stoppage time winner at Juventus. So Juve had two goals ruled out, one of them fair enough, the other one, the Di Maria one, a little bit controversial.
Yeah, I think that was very harsh for it to be called back for a perceived foul by Arkadiusz Milik on Stanislav Lobotka. And there is a sense of injustice at Juventus this season that goes beyond the points penalty for, you know, alleged irregularities in player trading. You go back, for example, to the beginning of the season when they played Salernitana at home and they had a goal disallowed, a Milik goal, which would have been a winner in stoppage time, and the VAR disallowed it without having all of the pictures available to him. And there was a picture that emerged afterwards which clearly showed that Milik was onside. So it would have been very interesting to see how the game against Napoli would have ended had Juventus been 1-0 up going into the final minutes of the game, because Allegri's changes looked to be the ones that were impacting the game more than Spalletti's, because Di Maria came on, great counter-attack, scores, felt like a classic Di Maria big moment. Vlahovic comes on, first touch, scores, although Chiesa had taken the ball out of play. I think that was quite clear that all of the ball was out of play. And Allegri afterwards saying, the things that have happened to Juventus this year have never happened before. You know, to be given this 15-point penalty, you guys don't know what you're talking about in terms of like what we've had to go through. And you have seen the pressure kind of tell. I mean, Juventus have lost their last three games, so even though they've got this points penalty suspended for a few weeks, the players, you can tell it's not been easy for them. You know, I don't want to say these things have happened because of the points penalty and everyone's eyes been on Juventus, but you've got Szczesny going off against Sporting with heart palpitations. You've got Nicola Fagioli being substituted and then breaking into tears on the bench after missing a chance against Lazio and giving up a goal against Sassuolo. You've got Moise Kean coming on and being sent off 40 seconds later for just rashly kicking Gianluca Mancini against Roma. All these things kind of are abstract, but yet indicative of kind of the pressure that Juventus have found themselves under. So, and of course, it's never nice to have the double done over you in the way that Napoli have done it. It's the first time that they've done it in, I think, 13 years. And of course, most famously did it in 86-87 when Napoli won their first ever Scudetto as well. So I'm sure Napoli fans will feel that, given their own sense of injustice of how the Champions League quarterfinal against Milan went, when they felt they should have had a penalty in the second leg, when they felt that the suspensions for Kim and Anguissa were harsh. I'm sure they won't care or cry for, be sympathetic towards Juve.
So Napoli can get the title sealed this coming weekend if they beat Salernitana and then Lazio fail to win at Inter on Sunday. And but about this points deduction suspension then, you've written a brilliant and very detailed piece on The Athletic about it. Was this always likely to be the case, that it would be suspended? I know that's what Jose Mourinho thinks. And what's the eventual outcome? Because there's an appeal to the appeal, right?
Yeah, I mean, on Wednesday, Juventus had this hearing, and it's the last phase of the appeals process, so it's supposed to be completely exhausted. Everyone was expecting a definitive judgment that Juventus would either have the 15-point penalty upheld and would just have to deal with it, or they hoped that it would be annulled. No one expected the judge to basically say, actually, I'm going to send you back to the court that heard this case back in January, the court that gave them this 15-point penalty. So we're going into extra time in this case, if you like, when there's precious time until the end of the season. So we don't know what's going to happen. That's messing with everybody's heads, particularly, I think, the Milan clubs, who have taken their eye off the ball a little bit because they've got this opportunity to obviously reach a Champions League final. So their form recently has really tailed off. And now all of a sudden it's like, oh, great, we're not going to participate in the Champions League next year if we don't get our ideas together. So it's messing with everyone. So there'll be another hearing in May about this specific points penalty. And then there's likely to be another separate sporting case, which could also bring a separate points deduction for Juventus. So in all likelihood, when the season finishes on June 4th, the table won't be settled. And yeah, Juventus could qualify for the Champions League by winning the Europa League. They're through to the semi-final. They'll play against Sevilla. They could obviously qualify by finishing top four. But these points deductions could come back. And then UEFA have to decide as well, because UEFA are carrying out their own investigation at this moment in time. And they might actually get quite impatient with the Italian sporting judicial process and saying, hang on, we've got to know who is going to be in our competitions next year. So it's a hot mess.
Do you think that the Italian authorities then might fudge it and say, if Juventus win the Europa League, okay, well, there's the 15-point penalty back because it doesn't matter because you're in the Champions League anyway. If they finish in the top four by 4 points, well, we'll take 3 points off you and then it doesn't affect the table anyway. Is that how they're going to do it, just to make their lives easier? Or?
Well, the mad thing about the decision on Thursday was that they've sent this back to the court that ruled on it in January, which means that if Juventus don't get the decision that they feel is fair, they can then go back to the Board of Guarantors, which was the court that ruled on Wednesday. And so there could be another 2 degrees in this case again. The season formally ends on June 30th. There absolutely has to be a decision by then. Otherwise, we don't know where we stand. And that's a nightmare for all involved. And yeah, it's a very Kafka-esque kind of situation where nobody, you know, the judicial process, I think, is its credibility has taken a bit of a battering, because, you know, you see, for example, in the Premier League, you've got the Premier League alleging breaches for financial fair play or financial breaches with Man City. You see what's going on with Everton as well. That's all been referred to kind of an independent committee. We don't kind of know when that will be heard, but it's not had any impact on the season in the Premier League so far. No one's intervened and said, actually, we're just going to dock you points in January and then take away those points in April and then maybe give you back those points in May. The credibility of the sporting justice system in Italy has been just knocked, because it's Sarri was talking about this with regard to Lazio's own situation. They're currently second and they're probably got a very good chance of being in the Champions League. But he's like, hang on a minute. Just like, no one's playing on a level playing field here. Someone from the Italian Football Federation has to resign, because it's, you know, the points penalty will have had some bearing on the psychology or the calculus that all the coaches have gone into when it's approaching certain games, their team selections. So I suppose the big question is the league table really telling the truth at the moment? And it's very hard to know what these teams are. All they have to do is basically win all of their games between now and the end of the season and then see what happens, because it just feels like the Italian Football Federation has essentially put the league in a cocktail shaker, shaking it up and down, and then we'll pour it out and we'll see what happens, you know, in June. So it's maddening.
From an outsider's perspective, Rav, you can kind of look at Italy and rubberneck and see, well, they're making a mess of this, aren't they? But as James says, it's the fact that it will affect other UEFA competitions, which means they need to come to as swift a resolution to this as they possibly can, because it has ramifications for clubs all over the continent.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think other clubs really care so much whether Juventus or another team are in the Champions League, but for UEFA, it's a big headache as an organisation to not know who's going to be in the competition, what the access list looks like, etc. Especially if Juve start winning other stuff, that might then shift down the places of who might be in or who might not be in. So yeah, it's not.
I mean,
great.
That's the thing. I mean, Juventus could qualify by winning the Europa League, but if they've been given a points penalty, which means they're outside the top four, how are UEFA going to view that? You've been punished, so perhaps we should punish you as well. So
isn't there a separate investigation by UEFA?
Yeah, separate UEFA investigation. Yeah. So,
and also coefficient for the clubs who qualify. Some would be in pot four, some in pot three, in pot two, and then the champions obviously in pot one. But it would will make the group stage of the Champions League very different if Juventus qualify or if it's Lazio, Lazio will qualify, but or if it's Roma or if it's Milan or if it's Atalanta or if it's this and that. It's crazy. Only in Italy, really. Let's be honest here.
I suppose the I'm speaking to a club this week and they were saying how the incentives are really skewed in Serie A at the moment because, for example, if you win the Champions League or if you win the Europa League, it doesn't mean that you get an extra spot in that competition next year. The most you can get is five teams competing in the Champions League. But for example, if a team that's already in the top four wins the Coppa Italia or in England, for example, wins the FA Cup, an extra spot in Europe does appear. And it's kind of like, okay, so why are you not getting an extra spot beyond, you know, the fifth, if, for example, let's do this. You have a league table, which is Napoli first, Lazio second.
Roma and Milan, and then Inter win the Champions League and then Juve win the Europa League. So you should have really six clubs.
Yeah. It's a...
Yeah, it is.
It's a and also, like, the way this season is scheduled, the Europa League final happens before the final match day of the season in Serie A, which, like... You have another scenario where, okay, well, what do Juventus do in that case? If they start to drift and fall out of the top four, do they just say, okay, we're going to put everything into qualifying for the Champions League via the Europa League? You know, what impact is that having on league football? It's wild. Sorry, listeners, that's just like a complete, utter mess.
And the
listeners are all gone at this point.
Yeah, okay.
We still have five Italian clubs in the semi-finals of the three. With all that mess and all that chaos and craziness, they're still having the best season in forever.
And I do wonder, so the league is pushing this message at the moment that Calcio is back, but we have the biggest scandal in Italian football for 17 years since Calciopoli, which has been re-exhumed over the last few days as well, which is just mad. But I do wonder, like, okay, Inter won the treble in 2010, but the last time we had lots of Italian clubs doing really well was in kind of 06, they win the World Cup. In 07, Milan had that points penalty. They had to start in the preliminaries and they got to Athens and they won the Champions League. It's weird how Italian football is like this Phoenix League where when it's torching itself, it somehow manages to rise above it and be successful. So it's curious how these kind of conditions seem to create competitiveness within the league, at least when it comes to European football.
And briefly then, before we move on from Italy, on Monday, Jose Mourinho has been adding a lot to his big book of grievances of late, hasn't he? And now he's going to put Atalanta's name on there as well. They've given their hopes of finishing in the top four a bit of a blow.
Yeah, and this is the amazing thing, is that Atalanta seemed out of the race for Champions League. And by beating Roma, they're straight back in it. And that's the last thing that the Milan clubs need with the Euro Derby coming up. It's the last thing that Roma need as well, because Atalanta aren't in any cup competitions. You know, we've got a Coppa Italia semi-final tonight or Wednesday between Inter and Juve. So that's going to be sapping, particularly for Inter, who are also involved in the Champions League. And so these teams that aren't in any cup competition, Atalanta and Lazio, could be a real spanner in the works for the Milan clubs, for Juventus, for Roma. So, it's just to see, like, Duvan Zapata, who's been out injured for most of the last 18 months, come back at this stage of the season and have a decisive kind of bearing on a big game. It must be quite worrying if you're Roma or one of the Milanese.
Yeah, going to be fascinating to see how the final table looks and the final table after that as well, I guess.
Probably won't know for 17 years.
All right, the Bundesliga is a bit more straightforward. We'll go there next.
This is the Totally Football Show, sponsored by LiveScoreBet. With BetBuilder from LiveScoreBet, you can combine markets from thousands of options to create your own bet on the biggest football fixtures in the Premier League, the Champions League, the EFL, and around the world. So if you think you can successfully pick the first goal scorer, the final score, the total number of corners, and whether there'll be a red card, then use BetBuilder from LiveScoreBet to make up to 6 selections and get a single bet with the combined odds. Or if you can't make up your mind, you can choose from the pre-built quick bet options. BetBuilder from LiveScoreBet. Building a bet just got easier. Find out more at livescorebet.com or by downloading the LiveScoreBet app on Android and iPhone. It's over 18s only. Full account terms apply. And of course, please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
Hello, I'm Ian Irving, sounding a little hoarse on Wembley Way after United have made it through to the FA Cup final. I am the host of the Athletics United podcast, Talk of the Devils, and we are bringing you our show live at Manchester's New Century Hall on Wednesday, the 17th of May. I'll be there alongside our usual cast of Andy Mitten, Carl Anker and Laurie Whitwell. We'll be sharing our unique insight and never-heard-before stories from covering United wherever they go. As well as reviewing Erik ten Hag's first season in charge, we'll also take a trip down memory lane to mark 10 years since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. Expect sweets and questionable cocktails aplenty. To book tickets, check out our social media channels for details, or you can go to myticket.co.uk and search for Talk of the Devils Live. Tickets are £25 plus booking fee. See you there.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Mainz a third straight home win against Bayern, said Bo Svensson. Possibly. Big Bo's boys blowing the Bundesliga title race wide open by beating his old mentor, troubled Tommy Tuchel's troops 3-1. Last two pods, Raf, you said Bayern don't regret swapping Nagelsmann for Tuchel. I guess that's still the case, but you've called them unpredictable to the point of being uncoachable.
Well, the teams seem to be unpredictable because they have good games and bad games, and there doesn't seem to be any relation to how they train. Tuchel said one day they train really well, then they play really badly. The other day it's they train really badly but play really well. I can't really explain what's going on with this team. So many players out of form, no sense of togetherness. You know, a team that really came together as late as a month ago against PSG, where they really played like a unit and it was so obvious that they were a unit, now look like it's just a random collection of individuals. There is regret that Nagelsmann was swapped for Tuchel. The regret is that it was too late. And people in Munich saying we should have done a lot earlier because a lot of the problems have been sort of festering. They were overshadowed, but the limelight was off them when Bayern won the league and sort of they muddled through last season. But it seems to be like, you know, the saying about people going bankrupt, it's like very slowly and then very, very fast. That seems to be Bayern's problem. They've really sort of broken down completely over the last couple of weeks or so. The Mainz game was shocking in the second half. They played really well in the first, took the lead, and you're thinking, okay, this is decent. And then they conceded a stupid equaliser and Jan Sommer again not covering himself in glory. And then it's just like no mentality, no leadership, no sense of, you know, we're Bayern Munich, of course we can come back. They just collapsed. And it's so weird to see a Bayern team like that. People are shocked and Tuchel looks completely, he doesn't know what's going on because, you know, he hasn't signed up for that. He thought this is going to be a very different experience. Because he's only been there for 3.5 weeks, despite some of the things you might read, there's no real pressure on him. Of course, it'd be bad if they don't win the league, but the blame game has long shifted, has long moved on from, still Nagelsmann, conveniently, but also the people above him. And that's the big story in Munich at the moment, what's happening to Kahn, what's happening to Salihamidzic. because you have the puppet master, Uli Hoeneß, in the background, sitting at Lake Tegernsee, but with very long strings attached to his puppeteering tools. And people are saying that Khan is on really shaky ground. The thing that's really important to understand is that this bad run of form is not really the reason why Khan and to a lesser extent Salihamidžić are under pressure. It's more of a pretense because Hoeneß has been unhappy with Khan for a long time. The success again papered over the cracks. Now that there is a crisis that is almost kind of being used to make changes or to doubt the leadership qualities of these people above them.
And how important will Tuchel's role be in the futures of the people above him? Because him getting on or not with people in boardroom positions has had a big impact on his previous jobs, right? So he presumably doesn't have the stock at the moment to be able to say, yeah, I don't really like working with Oliver Kahn. But at some point, if there's a fracture in that relationship?
They haven't really had a chance to strike up any relationship yet. I mean, Kahn and Tuchel are not directly working with each other. Kahn is the CEO of the club. He's dealing with a lot of admin stuff, with, you know, running a 700 million euro PLC. It's much more Tuchel and Salihamidžić and Tuchel and the board. I mean, they still haven't had this big recruitment meeting. I think it's going on this week. So there hasn't really been any time yet to fall out with each other. And it's not really about Tuchel. I think Uli Hoeneß, despite some reservations about Tuchel a few years ago, now likes Tuchel, trusts Tuchel. Tuchel talked about this meeting that they had where Hoeneß said to him, take good care of my club. It might have sounded threatening, but I don't think it was meant that way. So Tuchel might come out actually in a pretty strong position, especially if that cull above him doesn't stop with Oliver Kahn. But as a club, it does feel as if Bayern are kind of at war with themselves at the moment.
Surely,
which is not a great look.
Salihamidžić is the one. I mean, I know he's Uli Hoeneß guy, but look at all the recruitment that really failed.
Unasar.
The Mane, Mazraoui, Gravenberch, even Daley Blind. I've forgotten he was there until I saw something saying like, where he's going to leave. Of course he's going to leave. The guy never plays. You've played more than him, probably on that pitch. So it's just like, you know, how can Salihamidžić, it feels to me from the outside, that he's getting away with a lot of the criticism that he should be receiving also.
Yeah, and people are making that point. Mane is a move that hasn't worked out. It's hard, I think, for people to be too strong on that because when he came, everyone thought, what a great move.
Yeah.
Bayern have pulled this off, amazing. And now to sort of blame Salihamidžić for Mane not playing well feels a little bit easy. But of course, ultimately, it's his responsibility and it hasn't worked out. I think Gravenberch and Mazraoui, to be fair to them, is a bit early to judge them. Gravenberch hasn't been given much chance to play. In training, he does amazing things. Players are really impressed with him. And Mazraoui had this heart condition and I think started quite well when he played earlier. But yes, it's not that. It is players like Bounassar. It is players like Lucas Hernandez, who came for 80 million euros. And of course, he's a good player, but still, that is a number that's created lots of friction and tension, and his wages are really high.
He could get a new deal, no?
He could get a new deal.
He's got personal issues right now.
He got personal issues as well.
He was in the Milan dressing room.
Too many women involved in his life at the moment. And no, but you're right. Salihamidžić is under pressure. I just don't think that the board will want to kill, in inverted commas, both Kahn and Salihamidžić in the same transfer window, effectively, because now the big moves have to be made. And of course, Bayern themselves have said the absolute number one priority is getting that new centre forward in. And I think if you want to now take out both of them, that's going to make things difficult.
Have they identified which kind of center forward do they want? Because there are many that can come to our mind, but they need to have a prototype, right? What kind of striker do they want?
I not sure they're 100% set on the exact centre forward, but they want a guaranteed goal scorer. They just want someone who's going to be in the centre and is just going to score goals, even when Bayern don't play well. I think that's been a big sort of revelation almost, you know, when they've played badly in the past, Lewandowski would have still somehow scored two goals.
San Romelu.
Or you just, you just put in a couple of crosses and someone's there. Now you have to work a lot harder to get into the box. There's a lot more combination. And then the ball ends up with someone who's not a natural goal scorer. And they've had many games where they've underperformed their XG, which you could say is just unlucky, but there's a bit of a pattern. And that's why they want to bring somebody in. I mean, Harry Kane they really like, but they think it's going to be very hard, if not impossible. They really like Osimhen, and I think they might have a chance, but they're not relishing the negotiations with
De Laurentiis.
It's going to be very tricky. And Kolomwani, it would be, I think, the other player that's on the hit list. They've looked at him. I think they're not quite as sure as they are with the other two in terms of his quality. He's much younger. He's hasn't got the experience. He hasn't got the track record. And Frankfurt also want crazy money of about 100 million. At least that's their official position. So
I mentioned Rom.
That's it?
I mentioned Lukaku.
And I ignored the name.
Yeah. No, but I the reason I mentioned it is because Romelu actually had a good weekend. He scored a couple of goals, set up a goal for Lautaro.
First brace since May?
First goals from open play since match day one in the league.
August 13th, he hadn't scored.
But in that infamous Sky Italia interview he gave, which kind of put the end to his Chelsea career, the second spell of his Chelsea career, he obviously goes through his thought process.
Talked about Bayern, didn't he?
He talked about Bayern.
Yeah.
And how he saw himself playing for another one of the kind of legacy clubs in Europe, you know, a Real Madrid, a Barcelona, Bayern. So considering Inter's financial situation and how, you know, they keep saying he's going back at the end of his loan to Chelsea, then maybe we'll renegotiate it. But look, wages are big and that sort of thing. It does make me think about...
Well, with Tuchel, Tuchel would not...
I forgot about Tuchel. That's
did
it.
You really forget
about Tuchel? No, I did. I completely forgot about Tuchel.
Like, okay, he's going quite far.
That's it.
In his analysis.
But good. What? I'm glad the cogs in my brain finally arrived at Tuchel. Now that it completely rules that out.
I mean, if Tuchel is still there in the summer, of course.
But the thing is, when Bayern lost the league the last time, was it 2012?
Yes.
And didn't you sign Javi Martinez for an outrageous figure, 40 million?
Yes.
Oh, look at the Athletic
release,
fan.
Release fee, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. because that money helped us being good for 3 or 4 more years. But what I mean with this is that Bayern went for something that they hadn't done before. Are Bayern ready to pay a price tag of 90, 100 million?
I think they are. Because
they have to anyway.
That's going to be
nowadays, yes.
The only real signing that they need. I think Tuchel would like another playing midfielder, but they don't really need too many other players looking at that squad. So they can maybe sell one or two of the forwards who are not functioning at the moment. They'd love to sell Sadio Mane and then raise another 50 million somehow too, and then you're there, kind of. So
last question, Raf, is... I remember when Paolo Maldini was on the outside at AC Milan, he always looked at Real Madrid and looked at Bayern Munich. He's like, look, they involve the legends of the club in the running of the club. And yeah, I think he had in mind at that time Uli Hoeneß and Kalle Rummenigge.
Yeah.
But you know, obviously Maldini's come back to Milan. He's technical director and he has a sporting director alongside him. He's not CEO of the club. CEO is seen as like a proper serious position. Where you're, as you were saying with Kahn, you're doing admin, you're trying to grow the business as a club.
Whoa, really?
And this sort of thing. Is Kahn really doing all of that side of things?
I think he is actually quite good at that because he's run a few businesses before in the meantime since retiring. And he's quite a good communicator publicly. What he doesn't have is what Hoeneß wants him to have, which is that very strong familiar touch and being very warm with players, being very warm with the employees, having that kind of family vibe. It's not him. He's a former goalkeeper.
He's not shouting at people.
He's not used to having these relationships. He's a bit more of an individualist. Yeah. And I think that's where the big fault line is. It's not so much the decision making, because a lot of the stuff they've done, I think Kahn and Rummenigge and Hoeneß would have supported over the last few years, but it's more the style of the management. But you're right. I mean, one of the big problems is, yes, you can get rid of Kahn, but what happens next? If you want a former player who is now ready to run the club as a CEO, you're not going to find anyone. So even sporting directors, really hard. They ended up with Salihamidžić because Neerlinger didn't quite work out. Then they thought about Lahm. It didn't quite happen. And then already you're thinking, wow, Salihamidžić is quite a left field appointment at the time. And if he were to go as well, then there isn't any obvious buying figure at the moment. There's talk of Müller eventually. I think we will see Müller in a official capacity, but it's too early. Schweinsteiger, I'm less sure. Maybe Lahm could come back, but he's got his commitment with Euro 2024. He's the head of the tournament. So, yeah, big changes afoot.
Plenty of them to think about. On the pitch, or in the table at least, they're a point behind Dortmund after Dortmund put four past Frankfurt. Elsewhere, Xabi Alonso's Bayer Leverkusen into the Europa League semi-finals and closing in on the top four. You've written about them. It sounds, Ralph, like he's taken more from Carlo Ancelotti than he has from Rafael Benitez in terms of his man management, if nothing else.
Yeah, I think his man management is good, but it is much stricter than Carlo's. I think he doesn't have a fitness coach that smokes in the dressing room. And there's a very strong emphasis on discipline. And some person I spoke to kind of jokingly referred to the reign of terror at the training ground, because he's a stickler for details, punctuality, all these kind of things, which I think for this dressing room was important, because the dressing room is a bit tricky. It has characters who are a little bit relaxed and a little bit, I'm playing for Leverkusen. It's not my last club. It's not going to be even my penultimate club. I'm just here to go somewhere else. And it's hard in this environment to create that kind of team spirit and the mentality to go for every single game. Think kind of, let's push yourself. But because he's got such aura, charisma, and the quality on the pitch, even when he still plays with them, I saw him training with them. And every move starts with him, he says, okay, you go there, bang, he passes like 50 meters.
I did a show with Lamine Adli yesterday on French radio, and I asked him the question about how is Xabi Alonso at training, and he goes, he wants to show us that he's still there, and he's still so impressive.
The most amazing thing I've seen on a training ground has been Xabi Alonso just switching from one side to the other, 55, 60 yards with a volley. I saw that 1 meter away from me. I was really, really impressed. It was incredible, and he earned respect, because if Jose Mourinho has ever respected the player more than Xabi Alonso, I would like to know who that player is. Because
we'll see between maybe the first leg and the second leg. Leverkusen Roma.
No, but he, to start with, Xabi Alonso kept updated with the Premier League after he left Liverpool, and he was having many chats with Jose Mourinho about the Premier League, even Stoke City. I mean, he was following up, and also he was having tactical discussions with Mourinho before the game. So, yeah, he's a very special man.
And presumably they're keeping an eye on him in Spain, right? Is he a future Real Madrid manager?
Yeah. Or Real Sociedad, even though maybe Real Sociedad right now, with the status he's getting, it's too little for him. But yeah, I think Real Madrid could be his future. Of course, Raúl is the coach of Real Madrid Castilla, but I think that perhaps Xabi Alonso, could be first in the priority list of Real Madrid.
All right, Julian Nagelsmann.
Well, Ancelotti is staying. I don't know if Nagelsmann can wait so long.
Is he staying, Ancelotti?
Well, on paper, he's staying.
See how his contract.
The thing is that if he perceives that there is something wrong if they lose against Manchester City, because Real Madrid season is going to be decided in 12 days now. Osasuna on the 6th of May, the cup final, that is not so important, but it is important. It will set the tone. And then the games against Real Madrid. If he perceives, Carlo Ancelotti, that something goes wrong after that because they lose, whatever, he may consider his future. But there has been a change between Carlo Ancelotti saying last year, this is the end of it, I'm going to retire at Real Madrid, and what we heard like a month ago when they asked him about Brazil, and he said, I'm flattered, and this is very nice. I think that Carlo Ancelotti understands that maybe there is one more club or one more job for him after Real Madrid.
He's got to manage Brazil at some point, Carlo Ancelotti. The narrative demands it.
And Brazil is looking for a coach still. They've got the qualifiers in September.
Why does the narrative Carlo Ancelotti is in Brazil, why does that narrative demand it?
It's a great question.
One of the coolest men in the history of football, plus the coolest national team there's ever been.
100%,
are Brazil the coolest national team?
Mm. Yeah. Just remember that advent in the airport.
Coolest. Yeah. Socks in sandals, Germans.
Oh my God.
What about Carlo going back to Italy? Is that not an option?
Well, look, what Alvaro said just then about Carlo saying, I'll retire after Real Madrid, or that was the kind of original story.
Yeah,
that aligned with kind of a lot of what he said, because he's like, I want to be a granddad now. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to spend time with my grandkids. You know, or
that's national team head coach. Yeah. That's what you do. So it's perfect.
It's one thing to do that, like in Italy. It's another thing to do it in Brazil, where that must be an amazing job. But if you're not from Brazil, you're not Brazilian. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, but
it feels like it's becoming the impossible job for a lot of people.
All right, let's take a little break there. When we come back, we'll talk more La Liga, specifically Barcelona.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is the Totally Football Show, the Sports Podcast Awards Soccer Podcast of the Year.
Rafinha, que va a centrar para Ferran. Ferran se la puede preparar, tira, gol, 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 gol.
Mira,
toma, toma, Ferran.
Let's get on to Barcelona, Alvaro, because they won 1-0 again against Atletico at the weekend. The record number of 1-0 wins in a La Liga season is 11. They're on 10. Are they kind of 1990s Arsenal 1-0s, or is it a bit more enjoyable than that?
They can make it, and they are not more enjoyable. I think they can surpass that Arsenal, and the answer would be that this Barcelona, it's a side that they are just getting it right, but
they don't like the sun.
They don't like the sun, as Xavi said in Getafe. That's true. He was complaining about the quality of the pitch, everything, and about the fact that they were playing under the sun against Getafe a week ago, which, by the way, they were playing under the sun against Atletico the other day, too. The best answer for Xavi was came from Quique Sánchez Flores, Getafe manager, telling him, put Nivea cream on, you know. And I think that was the perfect answer for Xavi, who complains about many things, but he is going to win the league. That's the thing. I don't think that Barcelona is laying the foundations to be competitive in Europe the next season, but maybe the example of AC Milan can be good for them. They got AC Milan more or less a favorable draw, more or less, in the Champions League, and they are just making the most of it. Maybe Barcelona can do that next season with good defense, whose numbers are a little bit fictional, in my opinion, because they have conceded 9 goals in La Liga, I think, and they conceded 16 in the Champions League and you know Europa League this year.
Their XG against. They've overperformed that massively.
I think Ter Stegen saved 7 or 8. He's got the
difference. Ter Stegen has been phenomenal, and then the defense has been good, but maybe not that good. That's the thing. All that said, against Atletico de Madrid, you know, they had to win because I still believe that if they had lost this game, there would have been a little bit of pressure on Barcelona because institutionally the club is, as you know, in trouble, not money, this investigation about paying the referees and all that.
UEFA?
And UEFA, if Barcelona had been harassed by Real Madrid in terms of points, maybe they would have shaken a little bit. But now I think they are going to be fine. They beat Atletico. Atletico had been unbeaten in 13 games. They came to Camp Nou and Ferran Torres decided the game. It was a phenomenal performance of Rafinha, again, in the absence of Dembélé. He has stepped up and I think that this is his best ever season because he's playing for a top side. You know, maybe the most concerning part was Lewandowski. Because he had a one-on-one with the goalkeeper and he could have passed the ball to Rafinha, but he's so eager to score because he's not scoring after the World Cup that he took the chance himself and he missed it. They are using him and they are using Lewandowski. They are trying to pass him the ball, to use him as a target man, but you know, I think his numbers are fading, and whether this is going to be something that is going to continue the next month or not is still to be seen. But, you know, it's no coincidence maybe that Lewandowski is turning 35 this year if he hasn't already, and that his numbers are fading away so much.
Good they got Pedri back then. Are they going to have Messi back next season, Jules, do you think, Barca?
Yeah, I think so. Did you see the story that he went back for the weekend? He was on his bike yesterday, and they came back with 15 suitcases. I mean, I don't know why they were transporting, for all we know. But yeah, I think the move has started.
One thing about the whole Messi thing, we spoke about it last couple of weeks ago, and I was saying that it's very difficult to put in the same sentence that they cannot register Gavi as a first team player and that they want to bring back Messi. No matter how much Messi wants to lower down his wanted wages, still, I mean, there are players that, like Gavi, for example, that they really have to be in the first team squad. And Barcelona has to lower down their salary wage bill, 200 million, just to adapt to La Liga's wage bill. Bringing in Messi will require loads of financial engineering by sporting director Mateu Alemany. And, you know, there was an image that I saw the other day that it was so telling and so revealing about the Real Madrid and Barcelona and the disparity in their moment, their institutional moment and their power moment as well. There is a video circulating online of one of Barcelona's box seats, you call them, you know, where VIP people can go, where wealthy people can go and
people
watch
like
the
Jules.
Game from there.
Yeah.
People like Jules, who dress
I've got my season. I'm a coolie, you know.
I tell you, Barcelona's box seat, it's ridiculously bad. It looks like a police station from the 70s in America. Really, I mean, it looks like a place where you are going to be interrogated, really. And next season they are going to play at US Companies Stadium, Montjuic. They are going to play at Montjuic. You know, it's going to be a smaller ground. I think that that ground has still some athletics track. In contrast, Real Madrid the next season are going to play in the new Santiago Bernabeu. And everything about them right now is about grandeur. They've got the money, they've got many things, and Barcelona is lacking from many things as well. So, you know, the contrast between Barcelona and Real Madrid and the way Barcelona has evolved financially and Real Madrid has evolved financially in the last 5 to 10 years has been incredible.
Right, you mentioned the Bernabeu there. They're relaying the pitch for the fifth time this season ahead of the Champions League semi-final.
Yes, so
why is the fifth pitch going to be any better than the four previously, and why are they having to do this?
Look, I'm not an expert on that, but what I have heard is that they are trying a lot. Apparently, the grass is not, how to put it, like en routing well. It's just not happening. There are not enough sun hours at Santiago Bernabeu either.
Is this because of the refurbishment of the stadium?
Yeah, the construction.
Because this is what happened with San Siro.
Yeah.
It's like when they remodeled San Siro for Italia 90, all of a sudden one side of the pitch and one bit behind the goal became an absolute nightmare for the groundsmen, and they've had to basically over the years bring in sort of 4G pitches and synthetic stuff.
Same thing happened with Wembley, right?
Partially for that reason. There are new shady places that they weren't before because there are scaffoldings and all that. You know, and the players are not happy about that. The other day, Karim Benzema, I think that he missed a couple of chances, and he was complaining about the grass, basically pointing down. And you know, the players are not
Spaniards
very happy with that.
Spaniards complain about everything. The sun,
I mean, pitch. If a Spanish person complains about the sun, should move very far away from Spain to Siberia. But yeah, that's another thing. Hopefully, for the game against Real Madrid, the grass will be in perfect conditions because we know that Pep Guardiola is also the kind of man who doesn't want any bad surface. I mean, he loves playing in perfect conditions as well.
All right, well, we'll see how that one shakes out. Right, Jules, you've been very patient. That's about to pay off.
We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. According to their own survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Remember the last time you were hiring and how slow and overwhelming it was? Well, you don't need to go through all that again. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent. And because you listen to the Totally Football Show, Indeed is going to give you a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/totally. That's Indeed.com/totally. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed at Indeed.com.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, sponsored by LiveScore Bet. You can get the latest football betting odds at LiveScoreBet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
Another week, another record equaled by PSG. They beat Angers for the 14th time in succession. Well, apparently that's the joint best record for consecutive victories against an opponent. This was about Mbappe again, wasn't it? We were drooling about the assist for Messi last week, but the compliment was repaid for the second goal.
It was right, two assists, two lovely assists. Oh, I mean, one assist from Messi, one second assist, and Juan Bernat had the real assist for two Kylian goals. PSG were not good. They haven't been good all season. They're not going to be good now. The players don't really care. They've won the title. It was really boring to watch, I have to be honest. We had Arsenal on the other screen in my house as well, and we were hardly watching PSG on Friday. I don't know what more to say. I mean, the narrative in France, in Paris, was like, let's enjoy Messi for the last few games, there's six games left, because we know he's not going to be there next season. And against Angers, he's still the GOAT. So he was far too good for them. And they tried to play as well, which played into Messi's hands even more and Mbappe's hands, because they play a high line, et cetera, et cetera. But it's still lovely when he picks a pass like that and he's just like, wow, he still can do it. He just can't do it on Champions League level anymore against teams like Bayern, but he can still do it in Ligue 1 against Angers. So.
Therefore, then, has his move to PSG been a success or a failure?
It's a good question. I mean, the first season was tough. You know, I think he would admit that it was underwhelming the way he played. He had decent numbers, but it was not what we were expecting when you signed Messi, really. The second season was much better for the first half because he was getting ready for the World Cup. And he had some amazing moments. But eventually, the finality is that he was there to win the Champions League or to help them win the Champions League. And he was not good enough to do that. And the team was not good enough, but inside that team, he was not good enough either. He was not good enough in the second leg against Real Madrid last season. He was not good enough in the two legs against Bayern this season. In the sense that there was not enough of an impact from him, the greatest player of all time, in games where really he should have an impact. So on that level, it wasn't a disaster and it was not a failure, but it was still not what I think people expected it to be or what it should have been, maybe even.
So he didn't get it done in the Champions League. Speaking of which, Lens haven't played in it for 21 years. They might get the key to that door next season, though. Big win for them against Monaco.
Yeah, huge. They're, for me, the best. Them and Marseille have been the best team in Ligue 1 this season. They're not going to win the league, which is harsh for both of them. And Lens have been amazing. There's a huge Lens against Marseille in 2 weeks' time that will decide is the Ligue 1 like playoff spot for second or third, really. And third place can qualify, by the way, one of them straight to Champions League if Roma or Juventus or Bayer Leverkusen win the Europa League and finish in their Champions League places in their league, then that means that the French third team will go straight into the group stage of the Champions League. But that final is going to be amazing in 2 weeks, and the Stade Bollard is incredible, the atmosphere, the way they play, the intensity, the movement. Franck Hayes is doing an amazing job, and they just destroyed Monaco completely. Openda scored 2 more goals, and they were just so brilliant to watch. And when you watch them and when you watch Marseille, very unlike PSG, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of things happening. Tudor is doing a great job. There's movement. There's a structure. There's a style. There's a philosophy, which none of that exists in Paris, really, this season. So well done to Lens for that win. And then, obviously, they were waiting for the Olympico and see what Marseille could do at Lyon to see who was second and who was third at the end of the weekend. But Lens are a wonderful, wonderful story.
If you forgive me a selfish question, is Brice Samba as much as a cult hero at Lens as he was at Forest?
Yeah, he's now. And now that he's becoming a French international as well, or certainly in the squads. He's been, I think, for a lot of French people, a revelation. Who didn't, for example, see him in the playoff semi-final, that kind of stuff with Forest. And he left France being promising at Le Havre, then going to Marseille, which was far too young, far too early. And he lost himself with money and the parties and the girls and everything.
You've been there, Jules.
Of course. Who hasn't? You, maybe. and now coming back a few years later and just being this outstanding, maybe the best goalkeeper in the league, which is incredible.
Size. All right, we mentioned Marseille. They're attacking second place with gusto, quite literally this weekend.
Incredible on goal. We mentioned it in the moment of the week. It's the last kick of the game. It's a cross from the right-hand side. And first, it's deflected by Le Penant to the far post. And at the far post, Diomande, on the turn, tries to clear it. Doesn't see that Gusto is behind him. Turns, clears the ball onto Gusto and in the goal. And it was an amazing football match to start with. And before that, Anthony Lopez in goal had to save, to make many saves to keep Lyon in the game, like Cazette scored to make it 1-1. Cengiz Under scored the first one for Marseille. And in the end, I think Marseille deserved that win. And it was, I was watching Alexis Sanchez, who's 34 now, and who is, like we were saying about Messi being obviously still too good for Ligue 1. Alexis Sanchez is one of the best players in the league this season. And he is amazing. And I know it didn't really work out for him at Inter.
No, he did. He was, as a guy off the bench, like he scored 20 goals in 2 years.
Yes, yeah, to be fair, it's not bad. But he was not starting as much as he would have liked to.
But he was still, I mean, I would say one of the reasons Inter have tailed off and they're outside the Champions League places this year is because they don't have someone that they can look to like him.
It's just his level this year. Everything he does, the movement, his touches, and the first touch especially, the leadership, he's got 16 goals. It's just like, sometimes you forget how brilliant, and this is when you go to a lesser league in a way, that you realise, okay, how can someone at that age can still be so much better than a lot of the other players in that league that are really, really good players? And yet he's above everybody. It's remarkable. And they're hoping to keep him. I think a lot of it would be down to if they qualify for the Champions League, because I think he would want to play Champions League because he's still good enough. But he's just 34 and he's so fair and so driven and just everything. It's been an amazing signing for them.
And one of the best things that happened to Alexis, and this is a little bit contradictory, is the fact that the Chilean national team is not so good anymore. From summer 2014 until summer 2017, he played every single game for Chile. In 2014, there was the World Cup, 2015, Copa America, 2016, Copa America Centenario, 2017, the now gone Confederations Cup. And Chile reached the final in every tournament but the World Cup, when they lost in the last 16 against Brazil, I think. But Alexis was playing every single summer, every single minute. And I think that took its toll on him a little bit. And you could see that like 3-4 years ago.
Then the dog walking as well.
Yeah. Loves his dog.
Piano playing.
Yeah. Tinkling the ivories doesn't take too much out of you.
All right, I'm going to say that that was a pretty comprehensive continental roundup. That'll do for this week. James will be back in the hot seat next week. There'll be another Totally episode dropping into your podcast feed on Thursday morning, reflecting on the midweek Premier League action. Until then, many thanks to Jules, to Alvaro, to Rafa, and to James, and to producer Charlie, and to you for listening too. We'll catch up with you again soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by LiveScore Bet. Get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
The Athletic.